Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Siegfried, and you're listening to Back in the USSR. Over the past few weeks, I've discussed the overall state of the world at the beginning of 2021 and the empty promises of the Biden administration. Just name a few of the things I've talked about. To further elaborate on the latter subject, just to start things here tonight, it's worth pointing out at this that this latest executive order coming from the Biden administration, this time concerning the withdrawal of the federal government from dealings with the private prison industry, excludes the privately run ICE facilities where migrant kids are being detained in horrible conditions. So in other words, like so much that Biden has done thus far, it's not worth the paper that it's printed on. You know, those private dealings with the private prison industry are going on full tilt. Basically, you just have like a, you know, on paper, it looks like he's doing something about it. And those atrocities are ongoing by the, those racist atrocities are ongoing by the American state. Another depressing subject, you know, truly depressing subject that we'll touch on before getting to the good stuff here tonight is the utter failure of the Canadian government and Justin Trudeau in particular when it comes to handling the COVID pandemic. You know, I've talked a lot about this recently, but I mean, it just, there's just more levels of absurdity coming out each week, you know, and people are paying for it. I mean, a recent article in Maclean's points out the truth that Canada's performance has been abysmal in this pandemic. It's among the worst in the industrialized world, with COVID deaths nearly doubling in the past 2 months to just under 20,000. I mean, when I talked about it last year, it was around 10,000. Now it's close to 20,000. While the response has been hopelessly disorganized and fragmented along regional lines, there's been no centralized efforts, you know, worth the name to fight against this pandemic in a coherent way, in a cohesive way. I mean, as of January 31st, there were 770,427 cases of COVID in Canada and 19,659 deaths. That's horrific. Given the kind of resources we could muster, that we had the capacity to muster against this pandemic and still do, that's a crime. That's disgraceful. I mean, I've already gone through the details of the failed policies of the Canadian provincial governments in recent episodes. I mean, most notably the failure to close down non-essential workplaces, you know, and support workers financially and engage in mass testing of the population. You know, all these things which are perfectly reasonable and have been shown to work around the world in terms of stopping the pandemic, you know, getting infections down basically to zero. None of those measures have been taken in Canada. And there appears to be zero will on the part of the federal government to take charge of the situation and to impose a centralized response aimed at reducing the number of infections to zero. You know, the kind of response that has proven so effective in countries like China, Vietnam, Cuba, and New Zealand. You know, they're not all like socialist countries here. You even some like, you know, capitalist countries which have like a robust healthcare system and stuff have responded more, like way more effectively than we have. And have had some sort of centralized response that has gotten results. You know, we're talking like New Zealand, we're talking South Korea. You know, there's a number of other examples as well. But Trudeau doesn't have the spine. You know, I fundamentally believe he just does not have the spine to pay the political price and impose a solution on the provinces through the use of emergency powers. You know, which is perfectly within his remit to use at a time like this. I mean, this is an emergency situation, if there ever was one. And of course, his lack of action will almost certainly kill his political career, either way. But I guess he wants to go out with a reputation of being a nice guy or something. You know, I mean, that's kind of like what he's always cultivated over the course of his political career, you know, posing for pictures with people and doing these little impromptu meetings and all this sort of crap, you know. He's kind of always been about that. You know, he's the nice guy. You know, and of course, in this case, you know, being nice is defined as throwing a ton of mainly racialized and working class people to the wolves instead of challenging established power structures. Yeah, I mean, when has anything like that ever happened in history, right? I mean, Trudeau certainly didn't let this nice guy image get in the way when he was buying up pipelines and suppressing Indigenous land defenders. But forcing the likes of Doug Ford to adopt a sane strategy of disease control? Oh no, that would be too authoritarian. He can't do that. That wouldn't be a nice thing to do. So there is no effective response. You know, the capitalist state continues to impose business as usual, and workers keep dying as a result. I mean, the union demand, you know, perfectly, you know, like a crucial demand for paid sick days for all workers is just not enough at this point. I mean, the virus has spread too much. The situation is just out of control. Once again, we need to close down non-essential workplaces, get some sort of like, you know, CERB back in action, you know, so people can actually make ends meet. Like while the pandemic is being fought and they can actually stay at home, they can afford to stay at home and engage in mass testing, like meaningful, you know, isolation of the, you know, tracing of the cases, isolation of like, isolation and quarantine of effective, of affected individuals. I mean, we need to do this kind of stuff, but there's like zero political will. And that's why the situation is out of control. I mean, the overall picture is one of criminal negligence and brutal exploitation. I mean, putting profit before people's lives. That's what we're seeing here. Capitalist society downloads risk onto the individual worker and consumer. I mean, now they're telling you to wear two masks. Two masks. Whenever you go outside, whenever you go to work and all this sort of stuff to protect you against the new and fast spreading strains of the virus coming in from Britain, you know, where, I mean, which has just been kind of like a, you know, breeding ground of new strains of the virus, because they haven't gotten control of the virus either, because, you know, the messed up lack of response that they've taken. And to take, I mean, basically you're expected to take personal responsibility for your own health while the government takes no meaningful action, you know, doing nothing that could potentially threaten the profitability of business interests. So that's why Cargill can remain open in Guelph, even though like it's been like a breeding ground for this disease, you know, this meat packing plant, which is responsible for this, like the biggest outbreak in this city. It can remain open. Like it's not shut down. It's not quarantined. There's nothing, you know, it's a crucial business, you know, business in the local area, you know, Cam Guthrie, Doug Ford, they're not touching it. You know, they're basically telling you that you must continue to go to work. You must continue to risk your life for the economy, so that profitability can remain intact for the owning class. I mean, it's absolutely sickening. Absolutely sickening. But I don't want to continually focus on the nonsense that gets spewed out by a dying capitalist world order. You know, I also want to draw your attention, comrades and friends, to the signs of a new world being born. You know, stuff you're not used to hearing, you know. And I can't imagine why, right? I mean, given all the doom and gloom. But I've already talked a lot about the potential that can be seen in socialist countries like China, Vietnam, and Cuba. You know, not just in how they've been combating the pandemic effectively, but in other things as well, in terms of how they've developed economically, socially, you know, they're rising to take on a greater role in the world today, and they're helping other countries, and they're like, you know, Cuban doctors going around the world assisting all these different countries, including like, you know, so-called developed countries, and, you know, all the amazing stuff they've done. But today I want to zero in on what's been going on in India. And India, of course, is, you know, it's not a socialist country. You know, it's ruled by the BJP, a hyper-capitalist political party run by religious fascists. But any socialist who looks closely at the situation in India right now will see that India has as much revolutionary potential today as Tsarist Russia did at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, the parallels in terms of deep inequality, religious persecution, blatant and horrific levels of state violence, sweeping economic change, and the rise of new class formations are just impossible to ignore. I mean, like Tsarist Russia, modern India is headed for a reckoning, and the combination of the pandemic and the brutal neoliberal economics that have been imposed in recent decades, it's really pushed matters to a head. You know, things are moving very quickly in India right now. And, you know, it's a very exciting period, that's for sure. Very exciting time. I mean, I briefly mentioned the massive wave of strikes, worker strikes in India that started in November 2020 and involved more than 250 million workers, 250 million mobilizing together. And that didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, that's a significant increase from the 200 million workers who took part in the All India General Strike in January 2019, the 180 million who came out in a general strike in September 2016, and the 150 million who took part in a similar general strike in 2015. I mean, this is a level of labor struggle far beyond anything you see in Europe or in North America. And the workers involved in these strikes, these labor struggles, they're organized, they're militant, they're part of unions, popular organizations, and very notably, millions of them are affiliated with communist parties or socialist groups. You know, they're politicized in just like an amazing way, in terms of their political development and their level of consciousness and radicalization. And the same goes for the hundreds of thousands of farmers and agricultural laborers. I've mentioned this in a few past episodes, who are now taking part in the current uprising against the Indian state over its attempts to completely privatize Indian agriculture and put farmers at the mercy of capitalist agribusiness conglomerates. For 2 months now, they've been coming out en masse, you know, occupying parts of the capital, New Delhi, and provincial centers around the country. They've been fighting off attacks by the security forces, fighting them in the streets, fighting against fascist thugs in the streets, as they press home their demands for a complete repeal of the new farm laws and a rolling back and elimination of these neoliberal policies that have been just brutalizing them and destroying their livelihoods. So you see recently on India's Republic Day, you know, it's kind of Independence Day on January 26th, these farmers drove their tractors, you know, like en masse, you know, like, you know, hundreds of tractors, thousands of them, in the capitalist streets, you know, of New Delhi, defying the system that has been systemically smashing their livelihoods over the past 30 years. You know, a system that has driven literally hundreds of thousands of peasants to take their own lives in the face of crippling debt payments and other financial and legal burdens. I mean, since neoliberal policies were imposed in the late 1980s and early 1990s. I mean, these three new farming laws passed by the Indian government last September essentially take away what little state support that remained for peasant farmers, who must now compete directly with the big companies and landowners with no protection from market fluctuations. And the Indian government had the gall to basically say, you know, Prime Minister Modi basically had the gall to say that this was somehow helping Indian farmers. You know, that this actually would, you know, benefit them, you know, and would give them a leg up and stuff, you know. And of course, it was absolute BS. I mean, these laws are just the tail end of a long process of rural dispossession that has forced millions of farmers off their land and into urban slums, where they got to work for starvation wages in factories, you know, if they can get those kind of jobs at all. I mean, the destruction of the Indian peasantry by capitalist agribusiness has parallels with the destruction of the peasant commune as an institution and the consolidation of farmland under wealthy landowners that took place across Russia in the late 19th century, you know, as capitalism came to a, you know, and was transforming a basically feudal kind of like system in the Russian countryside. And of course, you know, the dispossession of the peasantry that fueled the explosive growth of the Russian proletariat, just like the Indian proletariat is growing by leaps and bounds right now, and its militancy is growing. So, I mean, that's what these farmers are fighting against. They're basically fighting for their own livelihoods. You know, their backs are against the wall. They're coming out and risking their lives. I mean, they're fighting against the police in the streets. They're like, they're coming out in incredible numbers, camping out, occupying the land, occupying the streets of the capital city. I mean, they're just, and they're basically saying, you know, we're not going away. You know, we're not going anywhere. Like, we will continue to fight basically until you get rid of these laws, until you, you know, until you put in policies that will allow us to survive. You know, and as, of course, they are fighting back against the police and the ruling party's thugs, you know, these fascist thugs which the BJP has organized. The same thugs that, you know, that lynch Muslims in the streets and, you know, basically have done all these, like, you know, Islamophobic, you know, persecuting enemies of the government and beating down, attacking trade unionists and leftists and all this sort of stuff over the last, like, several years. You know, sticking these guys on the farmers. You know, but the farmers, you know, this is just radicalizing them further. They are fighting back, like, tooth and nail. And they have the support of the working class as well, you know, and more people are coming on side, you know, millions, millions, and millions. And of course, it's worth pointing out, like, the another way that the situation of India and Tsarist Russia kind of, like, parallel each other. I mean, just as Russia was a world power in 1900, you know, with a huge military and rapid industrial expansion and growth, modern India has nuclear weapons. It has a space program. It has multiplying billionaires, you know, all these billionaires and stuff like that in, like, you know, industrial cities like Mumbai and stuff. And they have an expanding tech sector, you know. You know, India is one of the high-tech hubs in the world right now. And but it also has some of the worst childhood malnutrition rates in the world. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people die of malnutrition in India every year under normal conditions, you know. You know, not in, like, famine years or any or in during a pandemic or anything like that. That's just normal in India. For hundreds of thousands of people to die of, and children, you know, thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of children to die of malnutrition every year. And it was a very similar situation in Russia before the 1917 revolution, which is all kinds of horrific things. You know, were normal. You know, starvation, grinding poverty, you know, all this sort of systemic kind of violence against working class and oppressed people. That was normal in Tsarist Russia. It's normal in modern India. That's what the people are really fighting against. I mean, the present storm in India, you know, these massive workers' strikes, you know, hundreds of millions of people, these massive, like, farmers' strikes, uprisings. I mean, the present storm in India has been brewing for a long time. Just as the storm that broke over Russia in 1905 when the first Russian Revolution took place was years in the making. I mean, in 1905, Russian workers and peasants rose up in what was then the biggest general strike in history. Just like now, you know, what the workers are doing now with 250 million coming out and this sort of thing. Biggest general strike in history now, you know, setting new records. But, I mean, they had already been struggling for decades against, I mean, you know, before 1905, I mean, the Russian workers and peasants, they'd been struggling for decades against landlords, factory owners, horrendous living and working conditions, repeated and lethal instances of famine, and state repression and crippling debts. You know, they've been fighting against all that. And it's just like in 1905, it exploded. And it was Russia's costly and losing war against Japan that really caused everything to explode. You know, now you have the privations of the home front, you know, and just, you know, the privations of, like, this long losing war you are a part of, you know, and you know, thousands of people are dying in the war, and it's putting, like, you know, it's undermining the economy, and people are, like, having to deal with less and less, you know, get by with less and less. And in 2021 in India, I mean, it's instead of a war, it's an all out of, like, just an out of control pandemic that's causing everything to explode. I mean, a pandemic that's leading to economic collapse and and also exposing the callous disregard of the Indian government for the people's well-being. More than 154,000 people have died of COVID in India. And the Indian government was one of those, was among those that did not heed the warnings about the pandemic until it was too late. and even when it finally did impose lockdowns, you know, late spring, early summer of 2020, I mean, it was really late when they did that, the Indian state did so in a brutally anti-worker manner. I mean, they forcibly expelling millions of migrant workers from the cities and telling them to literally walk back to their home villages without transport, food, or income support. You know, I mean, this is the kind of pandemic response you also saw from like some neoliberal governments in South America, you know, where it's just like, okay, they basically just cut the poor off, you know, isolate them in their homes and like no support, no food, nothing, you know, and people like literally start to go hungry. They start to starve. They start to die, you know, in places like Colombia and Peru. You know, that happened on an even bigger scale in India. The only Indian region that took effective precautions against the pandemic in January of 2020, I mean, like, just was right out the gate, you know, was just on top of things, was the state of Kerala in southern India, which was, of course, governed by a communist-led coalition that took public health seriously, that was going to be proactive about this, right? I mean, in Kerala, the medical preparations and science-based response quickly brought the pandemic under control. And of course, there were enough robust public institutions in that state that could be mobilized, and people could be mobilized, and like in neighborhood groups could be mobilized, and mass organizations, political organizations of trade unions and stuff could be mobilized, and they could go out there and they could help people, and they could make sure that even people under quarantine would get by and do okay and come through it okay. You know, there was an amazing response there that brought the pandemic under control. And of course, that response also exposed the failure of the central government and its neoliberal policies and privatizations, which prevented any effective response countrywide. But then you have like this one state, which is like, you know, communist-led. It does an amazing job fighting the pandemic. You know, meanwhile, everywhere else, you know, like things are getting out of control. You know, and you have like this communist-led oasis, basically, in southern India, where it's like, okay, they... Right from the beginning, they bring it under control. They effectively mobilize and combat the disease, you know, on a collective basis. You know, like, I mean, basically their response was as effective as China's or Vietnam's or Cuba's in containing the virus. You know, it was the socialists and communists who showed the way and saved lives during this pandemic. And it's important to remember India is second only to China with regard to the size of its communist movement. And that movement is growing, and it's really been the only serious opposition force against the fascist BJP government and its leader, Prime Minister Modi, in the last several years. I mean, the BJP has become the party of Indian capital. Like, it's become like the Indian Capitalist Party. I mean, supplanting the old Indian National Congress, you know, which ruled India for most of its post-independence history, you know. But the old Indian National Congress is basically irrelevant now. You know, it's just like Indian capital. I mean, it's totally behind the BJP. And it's and the kind of monstrous policies which the BJP has been championing, which have like just put business ahead of everything, you know, profits over people's lives in every sector of society. I mean, the various communist parties like the CPI, Marxist, you know, trade union alliances, working class and peasant organizations, and indigenous people's organizations, they're now the true opposition. I mean, technically, they always have been, but I mean, they're the true opposition. And they number in the hundreds of millions. These people are fighting for life amidst a capitalist culture of death, basically. And, I mean, 250 million people participating in a general strike. That's one-fifth of the total Indian population, which is over a billion people. Imagine if one-fifth of Canadians came out in a general strike against austerity. And most of those 250 million people on strike last November, and, you know, like, even before that, like in January of 2019. I mean, those workers belong to the center of Indian trade unions, the CITU. You know, imagine that level of Indian, that level of union struggle, working class labor struggle taking place in Canada. You know, in the general strike of January 2019, I mean, General Secretary Tapan Sen of the CITU, I mean, he warned the Modi government and the capitalist state in India that it can, quote, neglect the huge anger of the people against its policies of selling the people's and the nation's interest to the corporations, domestic and foreign, at its own peril. The toiling people are rising, and they won't rest till they achieve their demands. You know, that was 2019. And now, of course, the movement is bigger. You know, the radical movement of workers and peasants in India is bigger, larger. You know, it's more militant than ever. It's fighting for people's lives, for livelihoods, for justice. There is a revolution building in India, comrades and friends. You know, and few people on the Western left have been paying attention. It's time that they did. Because history is beginning to move very fast. And these Western leftists are in danger of being left behind. Again. The people of India are ready to move mountains. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Yeah. ஆட்சி நம்மை சுற்றி போர் போற்றி திலகனச்சி அறிவு கத்தி சகல ஆஸ்தி சுவாஸ்தி அசுரராஸ்தி வெல்வம் உறுதி உறுதி தந்து உருவை வீட்டெடுப்போம் தகுதி அச்சவனை தலையெடுப்போம் மக்கனை ஜாதி சிந்தகள் அம்பம் செங்கொடி காரண பூதன் தானே முட்டன் குடமதிலேறிப்போ தூரப்போ அம்பம்போ அம்போ அம்போ கேரள மண்ணினாய் உயிர் சொல்லிய ஆயிரம் தங்குள்ள தீரசகாக்களை கேவல மக்களாய் தெருவில் இறங்குக சேர்ந்து பொருதுக சமரசகாக்களை
Thank you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Kerala Maninai, you know, from the 2017 Indian film Comrade in America, which I would really urge you all to check out. And then the second song we had was the Canadian reggae artist from the 1970s, Lillian Allen, with her song I Fight Back. And I really wanted to play her because, of course, we're getting into Black Heritage Month, Black History Month here on CFRU and, like, you know, around the country. And I'm really going to get into that in the coming weeks, you know, as kind of tradition on this show. Like, I really take this seriously, like, with this sort of thing, you know, at this point, like, getting into the Black radical tradition and getting into that, talking about people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson and all these kind of guys, you know, who really, and the Black Panthers, and, you know, who really fought for the liberation of Black people, you know, in the face of colonialism and capitalism and the various forces which are pressing down on them to this day. So expect that in the coming weeks. But what I want to do now is I want to play a talk. I did this a little bit last year. I played this, I think I played some of this talk at some point last year. But this was a talk given at the University of Toronto some years ago. Maybe I think it was 2016, when Vijay Prashad, who's an amazing communist scholar from India, he came and spoke there, and just went into the necessity of communism. You know, really, like, why this is so essential to build socialism. Particularly in India, like right now, under the kind of conditions that I was talking about at the beginning of the show, given what the working class, the peasantry is up against in India right now, how essential it is to basically fight back against fascism, fight back against hyper-capitalism, and to build socialism as the way forward in India. And he talks about the kind of conditions that exist on the ground there and why this is so essential. So I think I'm going to switch over to that now, and that's going to close out the show. So thank you for listening, comrades and friends. I'm going to be here next week. I'm going to still be as consistent as I can in making these shows every week, recording them from home. It's not really easy, but I'm going to keep doing it as long as I have to, like with the lockdown and everything. So until then, solidarity, and I'll see you then.
I'm going to just speak for, you know, a little bit of time, and I'll tell maybe four different pieces of this presentation. I'll give you the names of the pieces in case you want to keep track. They are condition, facts, politics, and anachronism. Now, it's interesting that the last one is anachronism for a talk whose name is The Necessity of Communism. So just get ready for anachronism. Condition. You know, before we met, I was in Delhi working as a journalist. And there were two landmark events that struck me at that time. I mean, of course, perhaps personally for me, the most important event was the anti-Sikh riot of 1984, when 3,000 Sikhs were killed, massacred, butchered really, in Delhi over a weekend. That was a very monumental part of my life. And I really would like you to see my cousin sister's film called Ammu. It's a terrific film. We were both deeply marked by that pogrom. And my first book actually was about the killers, as it were. I went to study the so-called killers of the Sikhs in 1984 in Delhi. And then I discovered that the story is more complicated. But in the early 90s, there were two incidents that really marked my understanding of what was happening in India. Of course, there was the collapse of the Soviet Union. But inside India, one was that Manmohan Singh in Bangkok decided to announce that India was going to the IMF. You might remember that he made the announcement in Bangkok, and we all, the people who were reading the press releases, discovered that all the spellings were American. And we thought, you know, well, obviously this document is written by some Yank and, you know, facts to Manmohan Singh, and he read it out. Because, you know, there was C-O-L-O-R. I don't know why color was in there, but I'm just giving that example. Maybe there was a flavor. I don't know what. But they were all American spellings. So that was interesting. India going to the IMF. You may not remember that India actually airlifted gold to the Bank of London. Physically lifted gold. I mean, think of the vulgarity of this. You know, there is no England. It's a petty, useless little island. You know, if not from the wealth that it stole from not only South Asia, but of course the Caribbean, and, you know, from enslavement of African people, and, you know, this pathetic little island, if it hadn't stolen all this from the world, it would never have had the kind of wealth that it had. I mean, there's no way they would have had an industrial revolution without the value that it had extracted from the bodies of enslaved people and mines in which Amerindians in Potosi and so on, you know, worked basically for free for Britain, for John Bull, for Queen Victoria, so that they could give us famines, so they could destroy our way of life and so on. And yet, when India had a balance of payments shortfall in July of 1991, gold had to be sent to England so that India could get a bridge loan. That struck me as the continuation of colonialism. You know, whatever people say, there was something obscene about that. Soviet Union might have collapsed, but this obscenity of capitalism was still front and center a problem. The second thing that occurred was in Silampur in 93. I was, again, a young journalist covering the riots of Silampur after the destruction of the Babri Masjid on December 6th, 1992. And in Silampur, there was a curfew because there was basically massacre of Muslims taking place. And during the curfew, I hid in a temple one of the nights. And a few, maybe an hour after I was in the temple, there was a big banging on the door, and this group of killers came in. And it struck me as they looked kind of ordinary. You know, they had their machetes, their knives, and they smelled of sort of sweat and, I guess, the smell of human blood. And we had to all sleep in the same place together. Well, a few hours later, there was another knock on the door. Now, remember, it's a shoot-at-sight curfew. And if you know anything about the Indian, you know, constabulary, including the Border Security Force, which was out around Delhi at that time, that they take this damn shoot-at-sight order seriously. So there was an old woman at the door, and she handed a small packet to one of these men, and he handed it to the leader, who was quite a mastan-type guy. You know, he was like a wrestler, real bold, tough-looking guy. Well, it was his mother, and she had delivered this package for him. Well, he takes the package, and he opens it, and he takes out the stuff, and then he shoots himself in the veins, and of course, it's his heroin. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is wrong. I mean, these are people who've just massacred other people, and he's a heroin addict. There is something deeply wrong in our civilization. There is something deeply wrong in a civilization committed increasingly to social labor and private accumulation. It was obvious that India was going to get much more unequal when all the different, you know, however pathetic those social welfare programs were, as they were all getting dismantled, you knew that there was going to be a serious crisis in the country. You know that capitalism is intelligent, that it tries to conceal from the masses of people this contradiction between social labor and private accumulation. You know that increasingly intellectuals are going to move from being intellectuals of the good side of history to being intellectuals on the bad side of history. That they're going to be out there doing at least two things. One, they become intellectuals of capitalism, finding new ways to get people to work harder, to work less. You know, whether it's people who work on, you know, Taylorism, things like that, but also finance, intellectuals of finance, trying to squeeze more out of people's, you know, inability to create a livelihood. But then there's a second set of intellectuals who create desire, aspirations, advertising people. You know, these are also intellectuals who come in and create a new cultural universe. More people entering the private media landscape. This was already clear to us in the news media. I started off as a news reporter for New Delhi Television. Then it was called The World This Week. I had really super colleagues. You might know some of them. One of them was mentioned earlier, Rajdeep Sardesai. It was a small office. And then, of course, the great genius and one of the most intelligent Indians who's ever been born, Arnab Goswami. So, you know, we were a very small office, and there was, you know, Chief Minister Arnab, who had already become an expert in terrorism. He had written a book which he used to try to flog to us every day. You know, you already knew that something terrible was going to happen in the media landscape, that a construction of an immense falsity of desire was going to take place, and there was going to be an exercise of concealing from the masses the reality of social labor and private accumulation. This is a degeneracy that was creeping into society, and it was quite clear that this new intellectual class, including this new political class, people like Lal Krishna Advani, who, you know, now, like George W. Bush, is getting rehabilitated, but Lal Krishna Advani was a venomous character, hateful man. You know, these are the intellectuals who orchestrated the idea of scapegoating in society. This is not a new idea for places like India, but the velocity of scapegoating was going to intensify. This was very clear to us. Part one, conditions. Part two, facts. There are 1.3 billion people roughly in India. According to a McKinsey study, 700 million of them go hungry every day, or at least don't know when their next meal is coming from. That's about one in two Indians, roughly. 300 million Indians, very conservative number, wouldn't be able to read that McKinsey report. 240 million Indians wouldn't be able to read that report at night because they don't have electricity. And stunningly, 1 million Indians enter the sewers of the country every year to clear them manually, despite the fact that there is equipment to do this work. 1 million Indians. There are more poor people in India than in the entirety of sub-Saharan Africa. India is one of the poorest places on the planet Earth. There are also millionaires. There are also nuclear bombs. There's also Narendra Modi. Now, 100 years ago, I think last week, Gandhi, okay, Gandhi, here I am, you know, I don't know, what's the name for me now? Let's Orthodox Marxist or vulgar, whatever. These are all nice names. Vulgar is fine, actually. I actually like vulgar. Vulgarity has a certain nice ring to it, you see, because you can be honest then. Gandhi, about 100 years ago, said something quite beautiful in Muir College in Pune. He said, the test of civilization of a country is not the number of millionaires it has, but the absence of starvation among its people. Now, 100 years later, it's clear India has failed this moral test. It's a very elegant, simple test. India has totally failed. Part two, facts. Part three, politics. See, I'm going quickly. But the thing is, part three is long, so... And I'm making some of it up as I go along. I'm looking down, but some of it I'm making up. So let's see. Politics. By the 1970s, yes, it is made up, so it's okay.
You mean the fact section?
Yes, the fact section is all made up. There's a sort of Borgesian thing. You can decide what's true or not.
It's fake news.
Yeah, that's right. 240 million Indians can't read. That's fake news. By the 1970s or maybe the 1980s, Indian freedom struggle, its reservoirs had depleted themselves. I mean, there was an exhaustion to Indian freedom struggles. I mean, for me, a good indicator of that is the Planning Commission meeting in, I think, 1985, when Rajiv Gandhi goes in as, you know, the head of the Planning Commission, even though prime ministers rarely came in and ran the commission meetings. Manmohan Singh was then the actual chair of the commission. Rajiv Gandhi comes into a 1985 Planning Commission meeting and says, why are you bothering about farmers and support prices and all this crap? Rajiv Gandhi used to talk like that. Why are you bothering with all this crap? He said, you know, you need to think about building American-style freeways. We need to have better airports. We need to have malls. Why aren't you guys thinking about malls? You know, which is interesting because they were thinking about the opposite of malls. How to protect agricultural farmlands, what's happening to farmers' livelihoods, things like that. Now, whether, again, they did anything useful with those discussions or not, the point is that was their discussion. This guy comes along and says, that's all boring. Let's think about becoming America. National liberation was really exhausted by then. There was a constituency among the so-called middle class. The word middle class inserted itself in place of the dominant classes. The word middle class can mean anything. What they really meant was the dominant classes in society were interested in transforming the kind of class compact that had been won through the national movement. And so what you see after 1985 is the surrender of the Indian National Congress. Already by the emergency period, Inder Gujral had come before the emergency parliament and said that we need to attract foreign exchange, we need to cut license raj. I mean, this was Inder Gujral, very fine man, very distinguished person, but he was saying this stuff in the emergency parliament in 1976. It didn't happen until 1990, 91. Slowly in the 80s, they were doing some things, but in 1991, it's a decisive break. You see the surrender of the Congress Party, and slowly from 91 to the present, those old socialistic Gandhian sections of the party got marginalized or left. You know, they went to other places, including some sections went to initially the BJP. The Samajwadi dynamic, the old socialist dynamic, also begins to lose steam. And you begin to see, you know, whether it's the Samajwadi Party or the this Janta Party or that Janta Party or this Lok Dal, that Lok Dal, Lalu Prasad here, Mulayam Singh there. One way or the other, they began to collaborate fundamentally with the regional bourgeoisie. I mean, the fact that we used to call the Samajwadi Party in UP the party of Rashtriya Sahara is not, you know, an idle comment. I mean, the Sahara group basically were the underwriters of Mulayam Singh Yadav's party in Uttar Pradesh. So there was a general surrender, in a sense, of the bulk of the political class, including some of the regional political parties, to this new policy dispensation. This policy dispensation, which favored the trajectory of malls and airports rather than support prices and, let's say, you know, some forms of protection for the poor. Now, this was itself very difficult for any political movement that wanted to chart an alternative. You know, those terms from the 1990s, from in 96, for instance, of the Third Front, United Front, Popular Front, if you draw the earlier terms, these were all terms with very limited content. Who is going to join your Third Front? Who is going to join your United Front? Who is going to come to you? These are questions that I'm going to return to in a second. If everybody else has gone in the other direction, how are you going to be able to create a national popular will to move the agenda in a different way? The left was put on the back foot by the mid-1990s. And this comes to that very important vote in 1996 made by my party, the CPIM, in our central committee. When the opposition groups came to Jyoti Basu, very venerable leader of our movement, and said, will you become the prime minister of the country? And our central committee had a very long meeting and decided at the end of it that no, Jyoti Basu cannot become the prime minister because he'll merely become the prime minister of a government with a completely different political direction. It's going to go in a completely different political direction. In fact, that government didn't last very long because there was just not enough political power. And there was no alternative national popular will that Jyoti Basu could have driven forward into a different direction, broken India into a different policy direction. There was simply not the will. In this period, as we see this surrender of every political party, including the Congress, especially the Congress, to this policy direction which increased inequality, which brought a great deal of agrarian suffering, at the same time, you see the emergence, rapid emergence of the fascistic RSS and its political party, the BJP. Rapid ascension. You know, and the ascension came on that one empty category. That's the, in a sense, the genius of the BJP's national political emergence, on that empty category, corruption. You see, corruption is an interesting category because it will produce the Tweedledee Tweedledum politics. Every bourgeois party, when it's out of power, will accuse the one in power of corruption. And then you can just go back and forth and say they are corrupt. And, you know, you'll create a consensus where people forget that both are corrupt. And you say they are more corrupt because the scandals are more recent. You see, because that scandal with Adani happened yesterday. And then when you come to power, you'll have your own scandal. And then you'll delegitimize yourself and then you can come back. This corruption word produces a consensus of one-party rule, essentially. With the difference in India that one party has this fascistic brain, the RSS, pushing it in a horrible direction. So what is the left to do? Now, I mean, I'm very glad we're meeting here not immediately after our defeat in Tripura. Because if we did, you'll just pile onto me and say, you guys are useless, you should close down. I'm going to come down to the you should close down shop. Between the defeat in Tripura and now, other things have appeared, which have, by the way, always been there. You might not know that in September 2016, 180 million Indian workers went on strike in September 2016. 180 million workers. My friends, what is the population of Canada? Huh? How much?
37 to 40 million.
How many?
37 million to 40 million.
How many again?
37.
What was that? How many times do we have to say that to come to 160 million?
Six times.
Well done. 160 million, how did they go on strike? I'm going to come back to that in a minute. That was in September of 2016. You know, the left hasn't done anything, left doesn't do this, we'll come back to that. Between the defeat in Tripura and now, we've had two major struggles, which I'd just like to point out. And I'd like you to go and do what every self-respecting person seems to do these days. Go and Google it. Number one is the struggle in Sikkar, Rajasthan. I'd like you to go and look and watch the NewsClick reports on the struggle in Sikkar, Rajasthan. I mean, these are very impressive agrarian workers' struggles. The other thing is, go and Google Kisan Long March, the march in Maharashtra, which was led by the All India Kisan Sabha. You know, this was an amazing march, guys. You know, they marched 160 kilometers and they arrived in Bombay. And they heard, the leadership heard that there were class 10 exams the next day, so they kept marching through the night so they wouldn't disturb the students when they had their examinations. I mean, these are moral, upright people. And they forced the BJP government, horrible government, to accept their demands. You know, this is also Indian communism. And I'd like to talk a little bit with that in mind. So I have some questions that I'm raising. I think there are three, four of them that I hope you find useful. And the broad section now is called anachronisms. What should the left do? The left exists, by the way. I've been a member of the CPIM for now almost 30 years. We have 1 million CADA members. That's 1 million people in our party. We have about 80 million people in our mass movements, including 14 million in the All India Women's Democratic Association, about 12 to 15 million in the All India Kisan Sabha. I mean, these are very large organizations. It's impossible just to say, oh, you know, I don't know, what would be the apposite thing? Close them down. I'm going to come to that in a second.